This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, September 4th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, poetry goes back to school. It's a cliche, but it's true. A lot of us learn to dislike poetry in high school. Poems tend to be analyzed, like frogs in chloroform, and we end up worrying quite a bit about technical things like iambic tetrameter and assonance. But with the right teacher, poems can get inside us and do their mysterious work among our tangled thoughts and feelings. James Langless is a poet who taught high school English for 33 years, mostly at Wheaton High School in Wheaton, Illinois. Now he's on the English faculty at Edison State College in Naples, Florida. Jim, one of your former students recommended you when I asked him if he knew of a high school teacher who taught poetry well. Can you give us a sense of how you approached poetry in the classroom?
Well, it took me a long time, I think, Curtis, to figure out how to do it. When I first started, of course, as a young teacher, it was the sort of thing where, okay, here's the book, let's read a poem, and, you know, let's find the metaphors in it, and these are all similes, and so forth and so on. Uh-huh. And, of course, it was just dead, I think, for the students. And finally, I just realized in order to reach the students, we had to have them have some fun with it. And so it was more of a, let's read this, and what do you guys notice in this poem? And see if they can talk about it.
And so you told me when we talked earlier on the phone that even if it wasn't a poetry class, you would often begin an English class just by reading a poem. Tell me about how that worked.
Yes, and I still do it here at the college. We do it at the high school. I'd walk into class and I said, hey guys, how's it going? Here's a poem for us. Let's look at this one. You know, if we didn't listen to it, I'd hand it out. I'd bring it up on the screen. And so it's just a matter of letting them, I think, experience the language before we get going in the other stuff of the class.
And you'd often read it. It wouldn't just be handing it out to be read by the students.
Yeah.
You yourself would read it. And I think that's kind of key to getting people to understand how a poem might be experienced, is to hear how some...
Absolutely. I had a student one time who said to me years later, I still hear your voice. And I think that was in a good way. But, that I didn't haunt this person in her sleep.
Yeah, it's also, I think, seeing somebody take pleasure in something and communicate that pleasure in the way that they read something is unusual. And I think that had to communicate itself in the classroom, right?
I think the passion for the word and the passion for how it sounds and what it looks like and how we experience it, I think that carries over with students. And that's a good way to keep it alive because we found a way over time in schools to kill it. And I've often asked students, I said, how many of you don't like poetry? And so many of them raise their hands, and I say, well, who killed it for you, or where did it happen?
And what'd they say when you asked them that?
A lot of them will say, well, and usually that word analyze comes up.
Yeah.
when we had to analyze this poem. And then it just became a kind of an academic exercise rather than an experience. And there's something to be said for that. But I think certly with young people, to keep it alive, we have to keep it vibrant.
So I asked you to pick out a poem from our website, poetryfoundation.org, to read. And you chose Out, Out by Robert Frost. Why did you pick this one?
I think over the years I found that this poem frightens people.
Yeah.
And I'd oftentimes start the class, I'd say something like, hey, how many of you people have ever been around a chainsaw?
Mm-hmm.
I say, I almost cut my leg off one time with one. How about you? And they say, yeah, you got to be careful. And it was always fun also to talk about the significance of the title and that great line from Macbeth, Out, Out, Brief Candle.
I was going to ask you about that after we heard the poem, but
yeah.
I think it's Macbeth ruminating on the shortness of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's set in Vermont, and someone is cutting up wood for a stove, not with a chainsaw,
yeah,
but in the chainsaw of its time, a gas-powered handheld buzzsaw.
Yeah, right.
Which is a ferocious-looking circular saw. Why don't you give this one a read? Here's Out, Out by Robert Frost.
The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard and made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood, sweet-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. And from there, those that lifted eyes could count five mountain ranges, one behind the other under the sunset, far into Vermont. And the saw snarled and rattled as it ran light or had to bear a load. And nothing happened. Day was all but done. Call it a day, I wish they might have said, to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work. His sister stood beside them in her apron to tell him, supper. At the word, the saw, as if to prove saws knew what supper meant, leaped out at the boy's hand, or seemed to leap. He must have given the hand. However it was, neither refused the meeting. But the hand, the boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh as he swung toward them, holding up the hand, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling. Then the boy saw all, since he was old enough to know big boy doing a man's work, though a child at heart. He saw all spoiled. "Don't let him cut my hand off, the doctor, when he comes. Don't let him, sister." So, but the hand was gone already. The doctor put him in the dark of ether. He lay and puffed his lips out with his breath. And then the watcher at his pulse took fright. No one believed. They listened at his heart. Little, less, nothing. And that ended it. No more to build on there. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs.
That was Out, Out by Robert Frost. Every time I read this poem, I'm horrified by what happens, even though I see it coming. And I can imagine your students hearing it for the first time being likewise horrified. So what do? You've read the poem, and then what happens in your class?
Well, first of all, I always find it intriguing to look at their faces. Basically, we'll just have a moment of silence until either someone says, "Oh my gosh," or something like that arises from the room, or you see somebody's contorted look. And then I'll usually pick up a key like that. I say to the student, perhaps, I say, "So what'd you think?" And usually that'll elicit, you know, this sense of horror. And I say, "Where do you feel the most horror in this?" So often they'll say, "Well, the ending, of course, where this boy's life seems to be discounted."
I don't know. I think that my horror comes from when it first happens and the boy holds his own hand.
Yeah.
it's not a surreal poem at all, but it's what people often describe as surreal when something terrible happens to him. That is just an unbelievable detail in the poem. It's so unbelievable, it must be true.
I have found, you know, it's interesting you'd say that, because I have found myself at that point, as I'm reading the poem, grabbing my own arm and holding it up, you know, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling, you know, like the hand, elevate the hand up.
It's
like, I agree, that's a horrible and lasting image, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. The scene he draws early in the poem is truly masterful. I mean, the buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard and made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood, sweet-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. You could just smell that wood, you know? And from there, those that lifted eyes could count 5 mountain ranges, one behind the other, under the sunset, far into Vermont. It's very cinematic, I have to say.
Yeah, I love that. And it is. It's very sensual, isn't it, with the sweet-scented stuff and the eyes. And I think this whole thing with the repetition of snarled and rattled is always such a great sound in the poem. You know, it leads us to talk about onomatopoeia and other things if they want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, this whole personification of this saw, as if saws knew what supper meant, you know, that whole thing, it leads us to other discussions of this beast that just wants to consume children.
Yeah, at this point, Frost is a master of blank verse. Do you ever bring that up, or is that something you just stay away from?
Yeah, I usually stay away from something as formal as a discussion of it, but I will often say, how does this poem move?
Mm-hmm.
Do you notice anything in the tempo of it, in the rhythm, in certain things? And so oftentimes we'll talk about that, but at that point I'm kind of judging if the students, how engaged they are.
Yeah, that could kill a very lively discussion right away. So we're going to skip right on by that and go to the next part of the poem, where the poem reads, "Call it a day. I wish they might have said to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work." You know, I would point out a flaw in the poem in this line, that a boy counts so much when saved from work. If I were teaching this, I'd say, I would say that a boy counts on so much when saved from work, which, of course, would ruin the blank verse of that particular line. Kind of interesting to point out that a poet can make a mistake. I don't know if it is a mistake, actually. It might have been colloquially correct in Frost's day, but it sounds to me a little bit like an awkwardness in the verse.
Uh-huh. That's a difficult part to navigate when we read it aloud, and I tend to agree with you there. It's kind of like that's a bumpy spot.
Mm-hmm. Another bumpy spot, this may have to do with me not being familiar with the type of buzzsaw that this boy was using, but the poem doesn't give a clear picture of how the boy cut off his hand physically. What happened? How did he lose control of the saw? I know that it leapt up, but generally with those kind of saws, you're holding them with both hands. So how did it leap up and cut off one hand right at the wrist, apparently? It's kind of smudged by frost.
Yeah. Well put. I don't have a clear picture of it. Mm-hmm. I guess it's one of those things that I think I probably glossed over in my own mind. I don't get the picture as much as I see this saw, strangely, I guess the image I get, is kind of airborne, jumping out. But yeah, I don't know how that would operate.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't have an image in my head yet, but I don't really need one. Something bad happens there. And then the boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh. That is bizarre.
I remember, Curtis, about that particular phrase. I can remember at times talking about that. I say, what does that sound like? What does a rueful laugh sound like? You know, is it ha or ah? What is it? Mm-hmm. You know?
And then the boy realizes what has happened. Then the boy saw all. Since he was old enough to know big boy doing a man's work, though a child at heart, he saw all was spoiled. Don't let him cut my hand off, the doctor, when he comes. Don't let him, sister. So. But the hand was already gone. What do you make of that so? So, but the hand was already gone. What does that so actually mean?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it's sort of this matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And it almost, in some ways, I look at it as kind of a preparation for this matter-of-fact kind of ending of life going on, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the way you see it or not.
Yeah, it just stops the poem cold, so, as if mm-hmm. those are the facts, and here's the rest of what happens. Mm-hmm. And then the poem ends, no more to build on there, and they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. No more to build on there. That phrase really sticks out. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, it's almost as if it's somewhat dehumanizing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Is this all the relationship and this family or these people is work?
Yeah, the boy seems to be suggesting that the boy was valued only as a worker and what he could bring to the family. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. Now, one thing I'm not really clear on, is it a pure family setting where the boy is doing work for the family, or is it a work camp and his sister happens to be there? I'm not clear. Are you?
You know, it could be a work camp. I've always assumed it was more of a family setting because it's the sister to come out and tell them supper. Right?
Yeah, that's the assumption I think most people make when they read this poem. Because if there is a sister there, the rest of the family probably is there as well. But what it implies then is that they're really impoverished. They see his loss almost in economic terms before they see his loss as a human being.
And that makes sense.
That's got to be hard to explain to high school students.
Yeah, because obviously for the high school kids growing up nowadays, I mean, it's like how many families work together for their sustenance and things like that. It's kind of a disconnect, I think, for a lot of the students.
Mm-hmm. So you read a poem like this and you get a reaction out of the students. Then what happens? What do you do with it? Do you go back to this poem later in the semester, later in the year, or what, do you just leave it there?
I guess I kind of use my guts to tell me, do we have to let this go now? Are there other ways that we can slide in some of the intricacies of poetry without, in their eyes, damaging the poem?
Yeah, but it's fun to talk about poems that you like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because there are things that are unexplained, and there may be some slight flaws, maybe not, in the poem. I think those are fun to talk about.
And another thing is I will often say to them, I'll say, you know, guys, I've always confused by this part. What do you make of it?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would show how a poem is mysterious still to me and then have them respond. And I think that does put them at ease because then they know that this isn't a formula. And I think they enjoy seeing that in a teacher who will say, you know, the poem's still a mystery to me, or I've never quite been able to handle this. And that sort of transparency, I think, is real important for building a climate in a classroom that values poetry and allows students to take risks with it.
Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Curtis.
James Langlis taught high school for 33 years and is currently teaching at Edison State College in Naples, Florida. The Robert Frost poem, along with dozens of others he wrote, is up on our website. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.